WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The hospital is in some ways peculiarly characteristic of our society. Within the walls of a single building, high technology, bureaucracy, and professionalism are juxtaposed with the most fundamental and unchanging of human experiences: birth, death, pain. So begins Charles Rosenberg's new book, The Care of Strangers: The Rise of America's Hospital System. Rosenberg is a professor of the history and sociology of science at the University of Pennsylvania and has spent the last 20 years studying the history of medicine. Sooner or later, just about all of us rely on a hospital for our own health care or for that of a loved one. Rosenberg's book traces the circumstances of the past that led to the medical triumphs as well as to the social and economic controversies of our hospitals today. Rosenberg visited our studios earlier today. I asked him to elaborate on something that he says in the beginning of his book. He writes, "It is no accident that both black comedy and soap opera should have found the hospital a natural setting."
I wanted to emphasize in the beginning of the book how, unlike many other modern bureaucratic institutions, school board, headquarters, the Pentagon, that somehow hospitals are very close to the most elemental human needs and desires, that no matter how high-tech the techniques are that you're being subjected to, somehow you're still a person with very basic human needs. And somehow the juxtaposition of the bureaucratic, technological, with these needs creates this ironic situation. And I just thought that metaphor was a good way of expressing it.
Yeah, you described the bureaucratic and the mystical being side by side in the hospital. I thought that was nice. Reading your book, I understood something that I thought I never really understood before. And that is, when I was growing up, a lot of the grandparents were really afraid of hospitals in a way that I thought was almost irrational. And they didn't want to go no matter how sick they were. And I always thought that they were adult enough that they weren't afraid of the pain. Do you know what I mean? They weren't afraid of medicine so much, but they had this terror about hospitals. Reading your book, I understand it, because hospitals used to be poorhouses, places that people who could afford to stay away from did.
Yeah, well, that's half of it. I think that the stigmatization of being identified as a recipient of charity for people up until the very recent past, and maybe up until the present, depending on who you are, has always been very frightening. It takes your dignity away, and was meant to take your dignity away. There's another part of it, too, and that is what you might call the more personal, individual sense that you want to be in your family when you're sick, when you're near death, when you're in discomfort. And traditionally, people who could afford it were always treated at home, and that medical care was always seen in a family context. And doctors wrote about, you know, how you'd handle the wife or the servants or the sick room. And it was only in the very historically sense, relatively recent past, that people went to hospitals at all. So I think that if your grandparents felt that way, it was a combination of those two elements, the strangeness and alienness of it on the one hand, and then this charity stigma on the other.
And there's also the terrible conditions that used to exist at some of the hospitals. You describe, in 1810, for instance, walking, what it would be like walking down the street, passing a hospital, and the kind of stench that would be coming out of the hospital. Would you explain it?
Well, I think we have enough impressionistic accounts of that kind so that what you say is pretty accurate. Everyone did agree that there was this hospital smell, it was called. And a certain amount of it, of course, was just bringing a lot of people together in one place. Remember, they didn't have modern sanitation. But also infections. People with any kind of lesion, would start smelling. I mean, it's very hard to understand today. But if you put a lot of them together, and in fact, it was natural for medical men and most laymen to believe as well that smell was somehow a part of the process of contagion. And one of the things they were afraid of in the period before the 1880s or so is infection in the hospital, because it was believed, and with good reason, that you had a greater chance of getting reinfected or infected with something different inside the crowded confines of a hospital than you would at random or in your own home. And that smell somehow seemed to embody that.
You also describe how there would be dirty, filthy sheets hanging from outside the hospital windows.
Well, not every hospital, but I have found accounts of individual hospitals, and some of them not just the almshouse, you know, city hospitals that were clearly less well-maintained than the more prestigious voluntary hospitals. So that the people who had ran those hospitals had an uphill battle in fighting dirt and contagion. And also, remember, they didn't have professional nurses. They didn't have a work staff that was trained in any formal way.
There is an illustration in your book of three patients in Bellevue in a ward, and there's rats. This is Bellevue Hospital, and there's rats crawling over the bed sheets that that the patients are lying in. Was there a really serious rat infestation problem in hospitals, or is this just somebody's horror story?
I think that it was media.
This is also from the 1800s. Let me get that clear.
This was from the 1850s. This particular picture was from the 1850s, and I think it was meant to horrify. I mean, it was meant to cater to all those fears in the layman's mind, laywoman's mind, about what a hospital would be like. I think it was clearly hype, I mean, in the sense of exaggerated. On the other hand, there are many accounts of rat and more likely cockroaches, bedbugs, lice as endemic and, you know, ever-present in these hospitals of this period. I mean, the rats are probably a little melodramatic.
So part of the problem if you were hospitalized back in the 1800s was that you were being put in an atmosphere where you were as likely to pick up somebody else's disease as you were to get rid of your own. You were exposed to bedbugs and lice, sometimes bad sanitation because of overcrowding.
Yeah, but still remember that I think it's easy to look back and say that this was a terrible situation. But it's also easy to forget how miserable the conditions were of the working class poor in 19th century cities. I know we have terrible conditions today in North Philadelphia, in the city where I live, or in South Bronx, and you know there are equivalent sections in most big cities. But the kinds of deprivation are very hard to even understand. People had chronic malnutrition. If you look at patient records, women often had not menstruated for 6 months when they were admitted. That was standard because of malnutrition. One of the most common admissions diagnoses was something called ulcers, which were just infections that didn't heal on your feet, and which we don't have the equivalent today. And almost everyone who thinks about it or has written about it assumes that it was due to malnutrition. People lived crowded in one room and had no decent sanitary conditions. Most of the patients were drawn from the working class, many of them immigrants, or immigrants from the countryside or from a foreign country, who didn't have a family to take care of them. So often, even if they had a decent job, they were skilled craftsmen when they were working. When they stopped working and got sick, they just lay there because they lived in a boarding house, they lived in a furnished room, and so that no matter how bad the hospital conditions that we've been discussing were, it was still a lot better than lying untended with no food, perhaps not even adequate covering, in a bare room. So that I think we have to adjust our sense of what the aspirations of the working class were.
My guest is Charles Rosenberg, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, The Care of Strangers, The Rise of America's Hospital System. Let's talk about some of the medical and social factors that started to change what hospitals were like. Why don't we begin with the greater understanding of sterilization and disinfectants that came about in the mid-1800s through the work of Dr. Joseph Lister. Now, just to put this into context, before there was an understanding of disinfecting in hospitals, what was surgery like?
Well, the revolution, I think probably the most important technical change, single technical change, in making the modern hospital a place where middle-class people would go and which became sort of central to medical care was surgery. And there were lots of changes. I mean, antisepsis was one of them. But, of course, the first major change was anesthesia, which was introduced in the late 1840s. Before that, not only was there tremendous danger of infection from any kind of surgical procedure or the treatment of trauma, you know, street accidents or workplace accidents, but, of course, the patient was in pain while you were operating on them. And you, they did give them alcohol and opium, which worked pretty well, as a matter of fact, but, of course, not like general anesthesia. So that surgeons had a very limited range of things they could do, given their, given those options. And they had to do them very fast, because the patient might die from shock, might try to jump off the table. They didn't handle the loss of blood very well. So the surgery played a relatively minor part in the hospital. It was interesting to the medical students, of course, and the surgeons had to have a will of iron and a temperament of iron in order to be a good surgeon. But the first major change did come with anesthesia. But, of course, just keeping a person from jumping off the table when you were operating on them didn't mean you were going to have a better outcome. And, in fact, there's some statistics that seem to indicate that outcomes got worse because they could operate more slowly, which allowed greater opportunity for infection. It wasn't until the 1860s and 70s, with Pasteur and Joseph Lister's work, that they began to think about the possibility of infection by microorganisms and to try to work out techniques to keep those microorganisms out of open wounds. But it was a long, slow process to get surgeons to accept and understand what this might mean. It was not something like anesthesia that was simple and easy to understand. And it took really about 25 years in this country for a new generation of surgeons to come in and more or less consistently accept what infection meant, the idea that one little tiny organism could have all these enormous effects on the whole body. So that was a very gradual period of change.
You describe how before that understanding, a surgeon might drop one of their instruments on the floor, pick it up, wipe it on his sleeve, and proceed with the operation.
And still think they were following antiseptic procedures. You see, because they had covered the instrument with carbolic acid before they started the operation. But it took a long time for the mechanism of how infection might take place to really sink into the surgeons' minds.
Once the medical profession understood more about antisepsis, how did that change the structure of the hospital and the kind of care patients got?
Well, I think, again, these changes are gradual. It made surgery more important in terms of the organization within the hospital, of staffing organization. Surgery began to move from homes into the hospital, because once you accepted the idea that antisepsis was necessary and then asepsis, of course, a rich person could try to turn their living room or bedroom into a surgical amphitheater, take the drapes down, clean it, boil water, etc., etc., etc. But it very soon became clear that it was much better to do it in a specially built room in which you could have an autoclave, you could have trained nurses that were experienced with operative techniques available to work on it. And gradually, surgery moved out of the home and into the hospital. And I think, and it's not only that these technical reasons existed, but that people began to accept them and understand them. People meaning laymen, of course.
I want to talk with you more about how the history of the hospital has led to the kind of hospital system that we're used to now. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Charles Rosenberg, author of the new book, The Care of Strangers, The Rise of America's Hospital System. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Charles Rosenberg is my guest, the author of the new book, The Care of Strangers, which is a history of America's hospital system. Let's talk about nursing, and you think that Florence Nightingale is one of the people most responsible for changing the American hospital and for changing the medical profession as well. Before she came along, who were the nurses in hospitals, or who performed the tasks that we now associate with nurses?
Well, it's a simple question, but there's a complicated answer. First, the generation of Florence Nightingale and her supporters painted a very, very dark picture. I mean, you know, in that picture, or history. All the early nurses before Florence Nightingale were sort of retired prostitutes or feeble alcoholics. The fact is that most of the nurses didn't fall into either of those categories. Many of them were not trained in a formal sense. They didn't go to nursing school and have credentials. But many of them were recovered patients who'd worked their way up, starting out being what in the effect aides, to use a term that'll be familiar today, and becoming a very responsible ward nurses, they were called. So they had a kind of on-the-job competence. The other aspect of nursing that is unfamiliar is that it was 50% male. It was assumed you'd have male nurses in male wards, female nurses in female wards. And they were assisted, on the whole, by recovering patients.
Well, you credit Florence Nightingale with thinking that the hospitals needed female morality and a middle-class female morality brought to it to promote the healing process. What do you think is the legacy in modern healthcare of Florence Nightingale's approach to nursing?
Well, there's one of her arguments was this kind of feminist argument that women in their nature had an understanding of the spiritual qualities that were necessary for healing. Another was that by being middle class, they could bring order and cleanliness into the hospital so that there would be, at different levels, this enormous impact on the wards. But as is often the case in many other areas of women trying to create a special role for themselves, insofar as they've based that role on some mystical, spiritual quality of women, they've painted themselves into a corner. Because if they're spiritual, well, then the intellectual qualities are somebody else's, namely the doctor's. And so that there's always been this kind of symbiosis between nurses and doctors in which the nurses have been subordinate. This will be unpopular with many nurses listening to this, but I think that there's been a de facto reform in which the nurses have moved ahead and gotten more and more status and more security, but it's always been as the doctor's lieutenant in the ward situation. And so insofar as the medical profession status has improved, nursing has improved as well, but always under the arm or the cloak of the medical profession, which is seen as having a higher status because it's in somehow in control of the decision-making and of the intellectual resources of medicine. One of the problems of medicine has been this consistent high status, the technical aspects, and perhaps less consistent attention to the sociological, psychological, quote, moral factors Florence Nightingale would have called them moral. We wouldn't quite use the word the way she does. And I think in that sense, the nursing profession has carved a role out for itself, but that role has been necessarily subordinate historically.
I want to skip ahead to the present and look at some of the reasons for problems that we're having in medical care today. We've talked about how antisepsis changed hospital life and about how nursing changed. The hospital system in America used to be mostly for poor people, as you pointed out, people who could afford to stay home and were cared for at home. And eventually, you point out in your book that wealthy people were given private rooms in hospitals, but the big problem was the working class and the middle class, who were neither poor nor wealthy, neither poor enough to be served for free nor wealthy enough to afford hospital care. Do you think that medical insurance is one of the most important factors in shaping the modern hospital used to know?
There's no question about that. And in fact, in the late 1920s and early 1930s, even before the Depression was perceived as a major problem, this social problem was of great concern to all hospital experts. In other words, they knew that middle-class people, because of this heritage of not wanting to take charity, didn't want to be in a charity ward. And they knew that they couldn't afford private rooms and private doctors' fees in the hospital. And going back to the very turn of the century, there were some attempts to deal with it. For example, many hospitals started instituting what we would call semi-private rooms. where there'd be four people, let's say, instead of the normal 28 or 24 people. Another technique was to build special wings of hospitals that were all semi-private that would cater to the middle class, because it was felt that it wasn't right to take a middle-class person and subject them to a situation where they would not only have to take charity, but be mixed in an ward with people with different habits, different language, and in a sense polluted is a strong word, but be subject to unpleasant social associations.
Another change in the model in the modern hospital is the kind of technology that we have now, which is just extraordinary. You write in your book that you think that the hospital is really a microcosm of our values. It's a microcosm of America's social values. How do you mean that?
I think that's probably no more than a cliche. But I think the hospital illustrates it very well, because it does concentrate in one institution the faith we have in technology, the desires for living longer, living healthier lives, a kind of secular salvation, a better life here on earth, and a willingness to pay as much as possible for it. There's a kind of what I call a technological gradient, that if something can be done, it should be done. That somehow, if in the worst case that might come into the hospital, machine X or machine Y might be necessary, well, then you need it, of course. And so we've become accustomed to not making cost-conscious decisions in the way England has had to make cost-conscious decisions. They just haven't been as rich as we have. And in the great period of hospital expansion, after World War II, with third-party payment in the Blue Cross, with Medicare, Medicaid in the mid-60s, was also a period of enormous technological change and development. You know, CAT scans and NMR, and you could just list it. List all the changes and take 10 or 15 minutes just to name techniques. And this was all in a context of cost plus reimbursement. So there was no reason not to invest in technology, because it was going to be reimbursed. And no one thought it was a bad thing, because, well, who wanted to skimp on health? But what's happened is that we've, again, to use the same metaphor I did before, painted ourselves into a corner where costs have spiraled so much that even under a Republican administration that has said it's dedicated to getting government off everyone's backs, they've devoted an extraordinary amount of energy to cost-cutting on a centralized basis. And I think that would have happened under any administration. We've
talked a lot about the hospital of the past and the problems the hospital of the past had. How would you evaluate the hospital of the present in America? I mean, surely it's no longer a lice-infested poorhouse. What do you think I think it's clear what the strengths of our modern hospital system is now. The strengths are now excellent health care, incredible technology. What do you think of the problems now?
Well, you know, some of the problems are ones that were perceived as early as 1910 and 1920. And I think that, I don't mean to be a pessimist, but it does indicate that they're very deep-seated and very built into the structure of the institution. One is this tremendous faith in technology, which manifests itself in the hospital in a disproportionate interest in acute care and not much interest in chronic or extended care of any sort. And this has been exacerbated by the demographic changes. In other words, we've gotten rid of most of the infectious diseases. The infant mortality pattern has changed. But we have a lot of old people. And we are not prepared to deal with either the human consequences, where are these people going to be taken care of, under what circumstances, or the economic consequences in terms of issues like Social Security, for example.
Have you ever been hospitalized?
Well, I haven't been. I was hospitalized when I was a child. I broke my arm, and I once had pneumonia. Actually, I must confess, everyone has a hospital experience. My mother died of cancer about 10 years ago after a very long and extremely unpleasant illness. And I was impressed at the time by the the disproportion, put it that way, between the technical skills of the physicians involved and the lack of human skills that they had. I'm not going to mention the hospital or location,
Sure.
And I had a parallel experience, very different experience, but one that illustrates another aspect of the hospital, and that is that I have two children, one 5 and one 23, and in the 18 years between those two events, those two births, the entire social context of childbirth changed in big city hospitals. When my first child was born, you know, husbands or others or affiliates were not allowed anywhere near the process. In fact, it was verboten to have any layman nearby. A lot of anesthesia was used, and by the early 80s, when my second child was born, it was much more nurse-centered. It was patient-oriented. Anesthesia was not used, but discouraged. And certainly the kinds of anesthetics, this is a technical question, I don't want to get involved in it, had changed entirely. And of course, husbands, associates, were encouraged to be there during birth. Now, without placing a value on which is better or worse, I think what's striking there is how the hospital responded to changing values and attitudes, everything from the feminist movement to consumer changes. And in that sense, the hospital is responding. It is a social institution that's responding to perceived changes out in the real world, which then become become demand factors. If hospital A doesn't do it, well, they'd better because hospital B is doing it. So that I've seen these changes, you know, personally, and have impressed me with the fact that even if the hospital does have certain rigidities built into the technology, it also has a capacity for change, even if sometimes you wonder about how slowly that change is taking place.
So we end on an optimistic note.
Well, I tried.
Charles Rosenberg, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Charles Rosenberg, and he's the author of the new book, The Care of Strangers, The Rise of America's Hospital System. The book is published by Basic Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with playwright Arthur Miller, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his play, Death of a Salesman. He's just written his autobiography. It's titled Time Bends. I hope you can join us.